Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. If we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. I'm here with John Wells. This morning, a revealing look at the tech industry and some blatant issues of sexism and ethnic and cultural bias that show a lack of basic humanity, from chatbots that harass women to sign-up forms that fail anyone who's not straight or who doesn't have, say, a Western-sounding name. We speak with a clever critic of the tech industry, web consultant and author Sarah Wachter Becher. Oh, I was hoping to get that right the first time. About her new book called Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech.
Good morning, Lynn. And then the science of bioengineering with investigative journalist Adam Piori, who has written a book called The Bodybuilders. Adam explores how engineers and scientists are beginning to reverse engineer the human body and mind with new technologies. From a world where the blind see with sound, an amnesiac remembers every day of his life, and a man paralyzed with Lou Gehrig's disease can manipulate objects with nothing more than his brain.
An interesting hour ahead of us for sure. Stay with us. We'll be back after these messages. It's Cool Science Radio.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design. Love your home.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
This is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with John Wells. First this morning, we speak with Sarah Wachter Becher. She's a web consultant and author who has written a revealing book about how and why tech products are designed the way they are. We can do just about anything online or even with a few clicks on our phone. But how is it that technology can be wrought with sexism and culturally biased elements that most of us don't even question until it becomes blatant? Designers and tech experts don't head into the office planning to launch a racist photo filter or build a sexist assumption into a database, but it happens. Well, how? Sarah has written a new book called Technically Wrong, and she joins us now by phone. Sarah, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, Lynn, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. Your book is, as I said, so revealing and so interesting from a standpoint of us not really realizing how much we all play into this as consumers of technology. And I want to ask you just to begin with, if I think a lot of people don't think they use technology that often. They try not to, but maybe you can just give us an idea of how often we encounter technology on a daily basis.
Sure. I think that, you know, there are some people who probably are not online quite as much, but for a huge percentage of us, you know, did you get up in the morning and check your email? Did you look at Facebook today so far? Have you Google Maps something on your phone on your way there to make sure you had the right directions? How many times did you look at your phone today? You know, there's a lot of studies actually that are saying the average person is looking at their phone something like thousands of times a day, picking it up, glancing at it, looking at it for just a moment. And it's to the point where I would say for a lot of us, you know, technology is just so embedded in the everyday things that we're doing that we maybe don't even realize how much we're engaging with it. And because of that, you know, it's become really close to us, sort of to our emotional life, to our communities, to our social life, and our political life as well. If you're watching the news right now and you're seeing just how much of a role Facebook and Google may have played in things like, you know, Russian-backed ads in the election last year. So it is really deeply embedded almost everywhere you look.
That's right. So you go through your book and you detail so many different ways that there is cultural, ethnic bias in all different kinds of ways, and blatant sexism as well. But let's start with something that I think that we all have experienced before, and we'll go to Facebook. And when you go to tag someone on one of your Facebook photos, it often knows who it is before you even say if you have used a tagging, you know, the tagging mechanism in the past to identify. And so this is one of the areas where technology has created this way to recognize only certain faces because that's what we feed in to the algorithm. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so facial recognition algorithms are very, very common now. We're seeing them all over. Like you said, if you go in to tag a photo on Facebook, you're also seeing that in all kinds of other image tagging systems like Google Photos. If you upload any of your photos there, it'll try to automatically tag them. Flickr does the same thing now. And it's also, you know, image recognition is what is underneath those different photo filter type apps. So if you use something like Snapchat and it adds a crown or some hearts to your face, there's an algorithm that can recognize your face that's doing that and that's able to morph your face to do things like give you big eyes and all these other things that it'll do. So those kinds of algorithms are increasingly common. And the way that they're designed is really a system needs to learn what faces look like by looking at a lot of different faces, right? So they are fed tons of examples of faces, and from that they learn about faces or they learn about other things in images. And one of the problems that's arisen in a lot of different places is that what these facial recognition algorithms have learned about is white people's faces or a biased view of what faces are. So on Facebook, what you might see, and I can't necessarily speak to this being a problem there in terms of specifically racial bias, but what you might see is that an algorithm for facial recognition will sometimes tag the right person and sometimes not. That's because it's going to get it wrong sometimes. But what we've seen in other platforms has been that the system is more likely to get it wrong when it's a person of color than it is a white person. And that comes back to it being better trained for one than the other. So a really famous example of that was in Google Photos, where it mistagged photos of a couple of black people as gorillas, which was just
horrible,
super upsetting to them. Yeah, because it's, you know, this is a racial slur. But the real underlying issue, you know, the fact that it happened to be gorillas that was a mistag, that was kind of that got all the headlines. But the real problem was that the system actually was more likely to make errors when it was pictures of black people because it hadn't been trained as well for them. And those concerns are cropping up lots of places. I know with the new iPhone coming out, which uses facial recognition, there's concerns that it, you know, the same thing could be happening there. And the reality is so much of this stuff is hidden. If we're not really paying attention, we might not realize it's happening. And I think that that's definitely a concern, as that sort of filters into all this other software that you might be using.
I have to tell you, I really laughed last night. I think one of the most recognizable graphics in the world is Maslow's hierarchical needs, the pyramid. And I really got a kick out of that. Of course, you start at the bottom, you know, with food and water and shelter, and then you move up towards self-actualization. But you have rewritten the pyramid with Wi-Fi at the bottom as our most basic need, and I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, no, I will say that is definitely not my graphic. I included that because that is one of the most enduring memes you'll see floating around on Twitter. It's been shared thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of times because people really relate to it, right? They're like, yeah, that's true. You know, how often have you, landed at, you know, gotten off a plane and been like, oh my gosh, get my data back on. What's going on? What have I missed? And that's a feeling that I think, you know, is pretty common. Obviously, not quite everybody is as tech obsessed as I am, maybe, but it's pretty common to feel that way. And that's such a big shift that's happened, you know, particularly with mobile just over the past 10 years, that I don't think we've really caught up to the implications of that, you know, and how much that has changed our lives and how much that can have some profound effects on things like, you know, whether technology is actually serving us or hurting us.
And 180 degrees from that great laugh that I had last night was when you scared me when you were talking about Uber. I try to stay away from Uber news because, you know, the bad boys of Silicon Graphics, Silicon Valley, you know, I just don't want to hear about them anymore. But you had a piece in a chapter titled Track, Tagged, and Targeted about how Uber would make you click on a particular window so they could track your location and say that basically they couldn't pick you up at the right location unless you did that. And once you did, it would default to that all the time, even when the app is closed, even when you're not getting a ride, so that they could track your movement at any time at all. And you talk about how they said, well, we're never going to do anything with that data other than understand, you know, if you got off on the right side of the street, you had to cross a street, maybe in an intersection, you know, they could learn things from it. But then you talk about how executives were using this God view of this data to be able to tell if somebody had a one-night stand or not. They called it rides of glory, or if they were tracking a journalist who was critical of the company. I mean, that's pretty scary stuff. Has that stopped? Have they taken that down?
Well, so the thing I would say about Uber is that they have, you know, they've had a really bad year. In the past 9 months or so, there's been just revelation after revelation about the culture at Uber, a culture of sexual harassment, issues with driver treatment. Their CEO, founder Travis Kalanick, he was ousted from that position, and the board was doing this long search for a new CEO. But Uber's problems, Uber's sort of ethical concerns, really go back much, much, much further. And some of those examples, tracking people's quote unquote rides of glory, so if they're taking an Uber home late at night from somewhere, where they ran a little experiment to figure out if they thought people were having one night stands, or where Uber was tracking a journalist. But those are examples that date back years. And I would say, I look at examples like that and I say, do I trust Uber to have additional access to information from me? And the answer to that for me is absolutely not. I mean, what this new setting was, and this is all dependent on how the iPhone settings work, but what it wanted to do was to be able to track your location at all times. And the reason it said that it needed it at all times was that the iPhone at the time, those are your options. You could track location basically when you're using the app or always. And there is no kind of in-between. You can't set it to, yes, you can track my location, but only 3 minutes after I get out of the vehicle, for example. So what Uber said is, oh, we only want to use the data from immediately before and after your ride. But the problem is, once you've given them permission to access it, then you have to trust they're not going to do something else with it. And you really don't know, and you can't know, right, because you've given them permission. And they're not a company that I would, you know, take at their word at this particular moment in time. And so I look at something like that, and I think about how much trust we end up putting in tech companies without really understanding the implications of that, without really understanding when we say yes to tracking location, what might that do? And it starts to feel almost like, you know, you have to go along with what they say. Because one of the things I really hit on in the book is that it's not just the data collection, it's not just how the algorithms work, it's also the way that that stuff is designed and presented to you. So the interface that says track your location all times, it's a really easy, clean click to say yes, and it's a really, really, really obscured, tiny link where you can actually decline that, and you can still use the app if you say no, but they design it so it doesn't feel like you can. And I think that that's a real overstep, a real ethical concern, that they're making people opt into things that they may not understand and that feel like they don't have any choice.
Is there any information on the government subpoena in any of this information? Are they able to get it if they wanted to for a court case?
You know, for that particular data, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if you opted into it being collected and it was collected. I wouldn't be surprised if that were available, but I don't actually have the facts on that.
And as you said earlier, everybody or a very high percentage of anyone that has taken an Uber ride would have opted to have that data collected because they thought they had no choice.
Right. And that's one of the things, you know, I talk about in the book is something called default settings. So when a company sets up its software and it'll kind of set up with the typical user settings, and even if those things are adjustable, think about something like Facebook's privacy settings. You can adjust 100 different things, but if you never go into all of those different menus and start tweaking it, you get the default settings, right? And most people don't tweak that stuff because it's overwhelming. It feels complicated, and it feels hard to keep up with. Every 6 months, there's like a new policy that comes out, which leads to new settings, and so you have to pay a lot of attention. And so most of us walk around with default settings on all the time. I mean, think about how many people have the default iPhone ringtone. That's because most of us don't change that stuff, and tech companies know that, and so they set those default settings with typically themselves in mind and not with you in mind.
Right, right. So not to keep going back to this tracking location, but I'm thinking of myself, the average consumer who's, you know, I'm somewhat adept at technology, but I'm not a digital native. I'm a digital immigrant. I'm thinking about, like, on Google Maps, it asks, you know, quite readily, you know, can we track location? I think you don't need to track my location for me to find out, you know, where a restaurant is. So I would normally say no, and I know that it functions anyway. But like you say, with Uber, we are led to believe that it's not going to function unless we allow them to track our location. So does it become the consumer's responsibility to get companies to change the way that they set up their digital presence? Or, you know, is it, I mean, obviously you're a watchdog and you're doing this for us, which is so great. It really brings us to some awareness that we might not otherwise have. I mean, where's the genesis of change?
Sure. Well, I think that all of us deserve to be critical of technology. And that's one of the things I want to get across, that I think the tech industry has kind of relied on the public being happy and excited about all of the new bells and whistles and you know, kind of feeling like it's just, well, those are some brilliant people over there in Silicon Valley making those decisions. I don't really understand it, but look at this cool stuff I have. And I think that there's a lot of great things technology has brought us, but there's plenty that average folks should be critical of. And a lot of it is not actually that complicated, and you don't have to be an expert to get the basics to feel comfortable pushing back. Now, the question of, you know, is it our responsibility to push back, and is that where change happens? I think what we're looking at is such a huge shift, right? Like, the way that we use technology now is so different than anything that we've seen in the past, and that's a cultural shift, and I think that means you need change on a lot of different fronts. I think, for example, we probably need to look at things like regulation, and tech companies have avoided regulation for a long time. Some of the regulations that do exist sort of predate the modern tech industry and don't necessarily make that much sense. And we also need people to feel more comfortable pushing back and saying, I don't want a service that's going to act this way. You know, that might sound like a little bit difficult in terms of, like, well, are they going to really listen? Are they going to make change? If you don't pay them any money, then you're not really able to vote with your dollars. So you can't just spend money somewhere else. So, you know, is this going to work? And what I would say is that what we have seen so far is that when there is public outcry, we are starting to see change. There was a major campaign this spring to delete Uber. Mm-hmm. And Uber started actually making change. A big sexual harassment case blew up there, and they brought in Eric Holder's firm and held an investigation, and it led to firing a lot of people. There was just a huge Twitter boycott last week over Twitter's failure to deal with sexual assault and abuse and abusive tweets. And this issue, I mean, there are people who sort of, like, disagreed with the boycott. There are people who are faking the boycott, but it was loud. And the Twitter owners noticed. And that company actually has stepped up and said, you know, we said we were going to take harassment on our platform seriously. We haven't done enough. And we're going to up the number of people who are devoted to this. We're going to be more transparent about what we're doing. We're going to give you updates on what we're, you know, what we're launching. And so they are starting to pay attention. I don't think that means it's all fixed. I think that Uber and Twitter both still have plenty of problems, but I would say that those are real changes that are starting to take place, and they are happening because a groundswell of people spoke out.
Right, right. And it makes me think about, you know, with Uber, we do have another choice. We have Lyft, right? But we are pretty addicted to these technologies. And often, you know, if you look at a Twitter or if you look at a Facebook, those are unique. There isn't really a substitute for those if you decide not to use them. And they have us over a fence in a way because we are so addicted to those technologies. I mean, or are we? Do mm-hmm. you think that we're more ready to give up a Twitter because of what they haven't yet done to address sexual harassment, for example? Are we able to give it up?
Well, I certainly know people who have. But I think it really depends what space it occupies in your life and what
right.
it enables you to do. For example, I know a lot of people, and I would consider myself one of them, who don't really like Facebook that much, but find that it is really the only way to stay connected with people you'd otherwise lose track of. And that includes oftentimes things like cousins, you know, family, mm-hmm. where it's where people are. And so I don't think it's realistic to tell people to, you know, opt out, cancel your subscription, just don't use it anymore. For some of these services that are very foundational, and something like Facebook, I think, is almost a special case because it is really the hub of the internet for a lot of people in a way that's almost like a utility. And at the same time, you know, it is a private company that is making a lot of money in advertising. And so it has a huge amount of power, and it has power that I think is a little bit unlike some of these other companies. And because of that, I think that it definitely deserves extra scrutiny because, you know, we're at a place now where Facebook has kind of said it wants to, what I would say is have its cake and eat it too. It wants to be able to make a lot of money off of advertising, and simultaneously, it wants to say, well, we're not really a media company, we're just a platform. And so what you have is a situation where they are doing a ton to manipulate what you see from whom, both in terms of ads and what you see from your friends. But on the other hand, they want to pretend that they're a little bit more hands-off, that like, okay, well, but we're not really responsible, though, for what happens here. And I think that if you're going to have so much of a hand in manipulating what people see, then you do have a lot more responsibility for what happens on your platform. And that's just a whole world of, you know, regulation or legislation that we've never really dealt with before.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Sarah Wachter-Betcher about her new book, Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. I'd mentioned to our listeners, that we've talked about several examples in Sarah's book. The book is chock full of examples, and it's fascinating. Sarah, you were writing in the book about how some research is not based on needs, but it's based on stereotypes. And you tell a story of a person named Fatima that was designing a smartwatch and some of the challenges that she bumped into. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a story that's, I would say, very typical of the kinds of stories I heard, largely from women working in Silicon Valley, although not only. So Fatima was working at this innovation center for a big company. So they set up these little Silicon Valley innovation centers to do their cool, exciting stuff, but it was a big corporation. And she was working on a project that was partnering with a fashion brand to launch a smartwatch that was targeted at women. And as she goes into the first meeting, she realizes she's the only woman in the room. And, you know, okay, that happens. Actually happens a lot in Silicon Valley. So, you know, she's like, okay, great. She's supposed to be the design researcher, so she's going to figure out what is actually necessary for this product, what people want, what people need, what's going to resonate. But when she goes into the meetings, it's over and over again. Well, you know, my wife really likes to go shopping. Well, I think most women are really just going to want to use this for exercise. All of these statements that were really based off of assumptions and really limited views of what the potential users for this product wanted. And even as she went in and did her research, where she found some really helpful insights, like, you know, she found that most of the top needs that women identified were that they needed things like, I need to be able to stay on top of things that are going on while I'm in work meetings, but I don't want it to be obvious. Like, if, for example, daycare sends me an urgent message, I want to be able to know that, but I don't want it to look like I'm looking at my phone. Those kinds of needs that came out of her research, she brought them back to the group, and they still would not listen to the actual real-life needs that women expressed, and instead kept insisting that this was about, you know, we need something for leisure time, it just needs to look pretty, the tech isn't that important. And as the project started flailing, they brought in a celebrity to help launch it. And what they ended up launching was this product that was totally based on stereotypes, and it completely failed because guess what? Nobody found it useful. Nobody wanted a smartwatch that wasn't smart for them, you know? And this happens constantly when we make these really, really limited assumptions of what people are like and what they care about, and we don't, you know, think about the actual challenges in their lives that we are trying to help them solve and consider them as full, whole persons.
A while back, an employee of Google who is no longer an employee wrote a little 10-page treatise called Google's Ideological Echo Chamber. And it was based on biology, not bias, or that leadership roles were rooted in biology, not bias. And it was really... Kind of a surprising document about the disparities between men and women in technology and in leadership roles. How pervasive is that attitude in Silicon Valley today?
You know, I would say that there is an undercurrent of it. It's hard to say exactly how far it reaches because a lot of people don't talk about it publicly, but we are starting to hear more and more stories emerge about this, where there are people in Silicon Valley, mostly men, who will think that the reason there are fewer women in the technology is because they're just biologically less suited to it. And there's some big problems with that. One of the problems with that particular Google memo was that the science that he cited didn't necessarily support what he was claiming very well, or he definitely over-emphasized small differences between the genders and turn them into broad generalizations. There's a lot of folks who have debunked a lot of what he said about the biology. But what I would point out about that particular treatise is that there was a big assumption underlying it, which is that if you're going to work in the tech industry, technical skills are the only important skill. In fact, he even said that they should be de-emphasizing teaching people about empathy at Google. And the thing is, I think he's got this exactly wrong. Right now, in the way that technology has embedded into all of these different elements of our lives, the emotional, the social, the political, we don't just need people who understand technology, we need people who understand people. In fact, that is the primary job, right, is to be able to design things that work for people. And so if you are looking for people to work at a tech company who are only technically competent, they're going to miss a tremendous amount of what they need to be focused on. They're going to miss, you know, history. They're going to miss communication skills. They're going to miss all of these other things that actually turn out to be incredibly valuable to making products work.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So at the end of the day, we need more people in from humanities, more anthropologists and people like that in our tech companies, right?
I would say that that's a huge way that we need to have a more diverse tech industry is we need people from different backgrounds, for sure. You know, for example, if you're designing an algorithm that's going to be looking at historical data and using that to make future predictions, which is what a lot of them do, like, for example, things like jobs hiring algorithms, they'll try to find, you know, based off of who's performed in a position in the past, who might perform in the future. Well, if you don't know anything about history and the history of, say, racial and gender bias in the hiring process, you're not going to have that in mind when you're designing the algorithm. So you need people who have that broad view, who have social sciences and humanities backgrounds. And also those people need to be valued. They need to be valued just as much as somebody who comes out of a computer science program.
Yeah, I like that. So great. What an interesting book. Sarah Wachter-Betcher is our guest, and you've done a great job here. The book is Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. And thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care, Sarah.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We're about to launch into another very interesting conversation about bioengineering with Adam Piore. When we return, stay with us.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
This is Beth, owner of Peak Art and Frame, local sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame offers local artwork as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Sarah Wachter-Betcher about the bias that exists in technology, and now we're going to move into human potential in bioengineering with investigative journalist Adam Piore, who has written The Bodybuilders. He explores how advances in bioengineering are making it possible to do things like reverse engineer human intuition so the military can train soldiers to just sense when something is wrong, or how to access and unleash untapped stories of creativity. He looks at robotics, prosthetics, memory pills, how to regenerate limbs, plus the ethical issues behind some of these technologies. A fascinating conversation ahead for all of us. Adam, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me, John. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Adam, tell us why you wrote this book.
Well, it's just, you know, I've covered a lot of things over my career. I covered Congress. I was in Iraq. I lived in Cambodia. But in recent years, I've been writing about science. And, you know, one topic that's always fascinated me is human resilience and human potential. And some of the most exciting stories in that area are being unleashed by technology today in the United States. And, you know, basically in recent years, we've sort of the computing power has gone up, our sensing power has gone up, and we're able to do things we could never do before. Basically reverse engineer the human body and mind at a resolution that would have been impossible before. So we're learning things about how the body and mind work and what's possible that we didn't know before. But also it's having an effect on people's lives. So there's just these great stories of people, you know, people who have lost the ability to walk, who are using new bionic limbs that feel like the real thing. I talked to a blind woman who can actually see with her ears. And then these technologies also can be used for augmentation purposes. So they're telling us about, you know, where our limits lie and how we might overcome them. So it's just a fascinating area that I wanted to dive into.
It certainly is. And who can forget the Borg in Star Trek Next Generation, where they want to assimilate humans into their hive of workers and with technology and things like that. So you know, some people say, geez, I don't know if we want to go there. But interestingly, we've been doing this for hundreds of years. We started with reading glasses. In 1958, the first pacemaker was introduced and implanted in a person's body. In the 1950s, the artificial heart came out, and then Jarvis implanted it in a body successfully in 1982. So technology has moved along exponentially since that time, and now we're seeing some of the benefits, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And, you know, it's only going to get, you know, more sophisticated, right? So in my book, like, you know, an example of what we can do now is, like I mentioned, bionics, which also, and it's based on it's bioengineering, but it's also, you know, when you look at the human leg, right, what they've discovered in recent decades is that it's basically a giant web of springs. Every time we walk, we recycle about 50% of the energy from the previous step. And the tendons, ligaments, and muscles juggle the energy. And, you know, there's not that many constituent parts involved. There's a few hundred. And but we couldn't really analyze them. We didn't have the computational power or the sensing power before. But now, if you've ever seen those commercials for EA Sports, or if you've seen the movie avatar. You know, they use motion capture technologies, and you can actually, you know, you can put these little metallic balls on all the different parts of the leg and measure how they move in relation to one another when somebody walks. And you can use computing power to build a model of that. And this wouldn't have been possible just a few, you know, a couple decades ago, but now there's a guy at MIT who's a double amputee, and he's built himself these robotic limbs that replicate the real thing. You know, and when amputees put them on, they feel like the real thing because they replicate these springs feeding energy back into the steps. And so that's something that we can do now. But when you look at something as complex as decoding the words that we're thinking in our brain, you know, we have billions of neurons, right? So we don't yet have the computational power to, you know, to use pattern recognition machines when we read what neurons are firing to figure out, to translate that into imagined speech. So I looked at different ends of the spectrum, you know, on something that we're doing now, it's reverse engineering movement in the leg, but something that we will be doing when you talk about the Borg and the human mind, the hive mind, is actually decoding our thoughts and, you know, being able to put them on computers just by thinking. That's sort of the far end.
There are so many fascinating examples in your book. If you could, well, let's start with this one, how the blind can see or could see with sound.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, you talk about therapeutic uses of technology, and, you know, like the pacemaker you said, but another one that has come about in recent years is the cochlear implant. And that's a remarkable, you know, I'll get to how you can see with sound in a sec, but what the cochlear implant does is it's different than previous hearing aids, right? Previous hearing aids just amplified the sound. What the cochlear implant does is it tries to get information into the brain that the machinery of your ear would normally pick up but might not work, right? So what it does is it takes sounds that come into the cochlear implant, it translates them into electrical patterns, and then it then shocks your ear and sends these electrical patterns into your brain where they can be processed and turned back into sound. Now, what they found when they made a cochlear implant is they were trying to they couldn't replicate the resolution that you would get, you know, the of the patterns of electrical pulses. And so when they first installed these in people's ears, it just sounded like gibberish. It was garbage. But they left them in, and after 6 months, the people's brains adjusted, and they could actually make sense of the patterns of electrical pulses. And suddenly they could hear again. And, you know, this is a phenomenon called neuroplasticity. And what they've discovered in recent years is that our brains are far more plastic than previously thought. It doesn't really matter how you get the information into the brain, but once you get it there, eventually the brain will reorganize itself and it'll be able to make sense of these disparate patterns. So I met this woman named Pat Fletcher, and she, you know, was blinded in a grenade. She worked in a grenade factory in her early 20s, and there was an industrial explosion, and she lost her eyeballs. And she loved nature. She loved to hike, and that was all gone. She was blind. Now, many years later, she was surfing the internet looking for some sort of technology that would allow her to see the color of different things, different clothes. She wanted to match them. So she found something. She wanted to be able to point a camera at something and have it translated into words that would say red, blue, green, so that she could, you know, match her clothes. And she found this program, but it also claimed to be able to turn things that you see into sounds, and that it could allow you to see with your ears, which she thought sounded ridiculous until she started messing around with it, and there was a sound of like a gate opening. And in her mind's eye, she could actually see a gate opening. And so she started messing around with this and using it, and eventually her brain adjusted and did amazing things. And I'll just tell you that, you know, the world of the blind has been described as profoundly claustrophobic. You can only, you know, you can touch what's in front of you, and that's how you sort of know what's around you. But when it rains, right, your perception of sound, it the world kind of expands because you can hear, you know, where the raindrops are falling, and you have a better sense of what's around you. And that's sort of how these soundscapes work. What this guy did that designed this machine called the Voice that Pat Fletcher was using is it takes a picture of the world around you, and it translates those pixels into sounds. So apparently our ears, our brain is capable of discerning between 30 and 50 sounds or something like that simultaneously, 30 to 50 different tones. So if you take a pixel that's lower down in the picture, closer to the ground, that would be a lower sound, and higher up in the picture, that would be a higher sound. And you play like 30 of these at once, you can sort of, and if something is darker, it's louder. If it's lighter, it's less loud. And you can come up with a consistent pattern of what they call soundscapes, translating the world around you, visual stimuli, into auditory stimuli. And Pat Fletcher, her brain actually rewired itself over time to be able to make sense of this. And when her brain was scanned she started looking at the patterns on the wall in her dentist's office. She started watching the steam rise from coffee cups.
Yeah.
And when she went to Harvard Medical School and they played these soundscapes for her, they discovered that her brain had actually learned to route this information, these soundscapes, to her visual cortex for processing.
Wow, that's...
So, and if they just jingled keys, it would go to her auditory cortex. But if they played these soundscapes, her brain recognized it as visual stimuli, which is quite remarkable, you know, and has all sorts of implications for other applications.
Yeah, great example of neuroplasticity. And I think we can all agree that we know, you know, the smell of certain things, a room can trigger memories. And so we've all experienced that. So that's the neuroplasticity along with today's technology and this reverse engineering is, you know, it's a very plausible explanation of how bioengineering is moving ahead. If you're just joining us, our guest is Adam Piori. He's an award-winning journalist, and he's written a book called The Bodybuilders, Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. And again, you give a couple examples in your book of this. It's sort of like reverse engineering, where you take a condition that is existing, and they study that to be able to create a completely different achievement or an advancement. And I'm thinking about this 5-month-old little kid who had this incredible strength, could form a human T in midair, just holding on to his mom's hand. And they studied him, this Liam Hoekstra, and they were able to take this technology into help people with rare muscle wasting diseases. And so could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I wanted to look at genetic engineering, you know, which we've been hearing a lot about. There's this new technology that called CRISPR, right? Which
yes.
Allows gene editing and in very precise ways. And, you know, again, there's a spectrum in terms of what we can figure out. Like a lot of our traits are a combination between many different genes and environmental factors. So in this chapter, I looked at intelligence, right? They're trying to reverse engineer intelligence, and that's really hard to do. And again, it's a question of processing power. Like we have 3 billion nucleotide genomes, right? And you have to figure out what of those genes are associated with intelligence, and that's beyond our capacity right now. But I wanted to look at something that we can do right now, and there are some traits that, if you just tweak one gene, you can have a profound effect on a person. And one of these traits is believed to have been found in Liam Hoekstra. And actually, an anonymous baby they found in Germany was the first baby. It was called, what was he called? Super Baby, they called him, right? And he had this mutation that had previously been found in mice and dogs and even in some cattle. And it's for a protein, and there's a protein called myostatin. And what myostatin does, stressed, it actually limits our muscle growth, keeps it under control. It's what's called a negative regulator.
Yeah.
So if you have a mutation in that gene and your body can't make myostatin, then your muscles just, it's like the brakes are missing. They continue to grow. I mean, they don't grow infinitely, but they grow much larger than they otherwise would. And that's what they believe Liam Hoekstra had. And, you know, he was able to, his parents realized he was totally different, you know. Like you said, he grabbed onto his mom's fingers and hoisted himself up into a human T, which is something that, you know, gymnasts
most of us
do.
Can't do.
and he punched a hole in the wall and, you know, could push around furniture. And so this is something that could be used to help elderly people with muscle, you know, whose muscles deteriorate with age, and also to save lives of people who have muscle wasting disease, right? Like Shane's muscular dystrophy. But of course, it's also might appeal to weightlifters and people who want to, you know, would otherwise take steroids. Now they can, what's called gene dope, right? They can try and tweak their genes and.
They don't produce the myostatin. Yeah, that is what makes bioengineering scary at the same time really exciting.
I went to this place in my book in China called the Beijing Genomics Institute, BGI, where they're attempting to reverse engineer intelligence. And I asked one of the guys involved, I said, well, you know, a lot of people have ethical concerns, you know, couldn't it lead to an arms race, you know, who will benefit from this? And he said, well, I think everybody will have access to this, and a parent should be able to determine. It would be a great thing if they could decide how intelligent their child will become if we crack the code of intelligence. And I said, well, is there anything that alarms you? And he said, well, yeah, I could imagine like a really ruthless tiger mom who wants to engineer her child, not just with intelligence, but with a lack of empathy that you find in sociopaths so they can get ahead.
Yeah, design a psychopath.
Right.
Really, who wants that other than a psychopath?
Yeah.
But also talk about the correlation, if you would, between the study of amnesia and how they're reverse engineering, and I think it correlates to intuition or helping in a military setting, for example, develop a sense of when something's just not right.
Right. I found this was pretty fascinating, too. And it has to do with the sensing technologies, the advances in sensing technologies that we have come up with in recent years. And again, the common theme here is just that some of the most talented engineers are turning their sights inward. Instead of building spaceships and skyscrapers, they're turning their sights inward to decode how the body and mind work. But the military, they were finding that, and you might have heard, you know, I'd heard this before, you know, you hear about the Vietnam vet who'd been around a long time and could just sense when an ambush was about to happen and would stop in the jungle. They were noticing the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. A lot of people were coming back and they were reporting that, you know, there's this one guy in my squad, he always knows, seems to know when something bad is about to happen, and he'll tell us to stop, and then we stop, and right before the ambush. Or there's a guy who goes on convoys, and he tells the convoys to stop and says something's wrong, but he can't say exactly what it is. And then sure enough, when we send people out, we find that there's hidden IEDs. And so they wanted to know if this was something that they could actually identify as a real phenomenon, and if they could find a way to train it in people. So they funded some studies to look at intuition. And what they found is indeed there is a neural signature of intuition, and they think they might be able to find ways to train it. So I can't tell you the whole story here, but some of the neuroscientists I talked to, some of the research suggests that, you mentioned the amnesia. So there's been evidence of what they call implicit learning for many decades, right? So one example is, there was a doctor, I think, in the 1920s, who he had a patient who every day, you know, she had lost the portions of her brain that they'd been removed or destroyed that were involved in storing long-term memories. So every day when he would come and meet her, he had to introduce himself again, and she would behave as if she never met him and she didn't remember who he was, and they would shake hands. So he wanted to see how far this went. So he put a pin in his hand, and when he shook her hand, he pricked her with the pin, and she went, ouch. So the next day he came back to introduce himself like always, and she didn't remember him, but she refused to shake his hand.
Yeah.
So somehow, on some level, she had registered that, you know, if she shook his hand, she'd get poked again. And they've seen this in other amnesiacs. They've seen, you know, some of the people, there's a famous amnesiac named H.M. that they've learned a lot about, and he could not remember what had happened the previous day, but he could learn how to walk home. He could learn where the bathroom was in his house. They did tests to try and figure out what this is. And, you know, what some neuroscientists have discovered is that there's different kinds of memory. And so we use these structures in our brain called the hippocampus and amygdala, you know, to store what they call explicit memory, which is sort of somebody's telephone number or who somebody is. But with some tasks, there's, you know, we use different parts of of the brain, like the basal ganglia and other things. And a good example of this is motor memory, when you learn how to ride a bike, right? So an amnesiac can learn how to ride a bike, because that uses implicit memory. Or when we're driving home and we don't, suddenly we're in our driveway and we don't remember getting there because we have done something so much that it's automatic. So what they've discovered is that just like muscle memory, we seem to have implicit memory for visual stimuli, or just a whole pattern of sensory stimuli. So somehow that person who is able to sense danger in Iraq, you know, maybe an IED or that there's going to be an ambush, is able to sense a constellation of sensory stimuli that tells them almost unconsciously that they should be on guard. And you see this, there's a guy in Ohio, his name was Gary Klein, and he wanted to see how firefighters make decisions. People make decisions under pressure. And so he thought that what they would do is they would choose a whole bunch of choices and intellectually decide what to do. But what he found was trained, seasoned firefighters. He went out and interviewed all these people who in Cleveland firehouses. They don't usually think about all the options. They just know what to do. And there's one famous case where there was a fire chief who was in a house fire, and there was they kept spraying the kitchen fire, and the flames weren't going out. And then he said, "Man, we have to get out of here now. Something's not right." And he rushed all his men out, and right after he rushed them out, the floor that they had been standing on collapsed. And for many years, he thought he had ESP. But what it turned out happened, and Klein showed this, is that there was what he called a pattern mismatch. So the flames coming out and of the kitchen and the amount of smoke that was produced were not sufficient to account for how hot it was in that room. And that's what sort of set the alarm bells ringing for him. So he couldn't say what was wrong, but he knew something was wrong. And what it turned out had happened was the fire was in the basement, right? And so it was heating up the floor and heating up everything. And he sensed that something bad was about to happen, and he got his men out. And then the basement floor collapsed because of the fire underneath.
Right.
So that was something that he knew intuitively. It was implicit learning. So you can train that potentially in the military, but with drill training, just like you would train somebody to hit a baseball or drive a car and stuff. That's the idea.
Adam, we're almost out of time. I wanted to mention to our listeners that in addition to writing The Bodybuilders, you're a former editor and correspondent for Newsweek. Your articles have appeared in GQ, Nautilus, Discover, Mother Jones, Playboy, Scientific American, Business Week, and many others. We just have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you a quick question because I was intrigued by this, and that was you had the opportunity to spend the day watching a neurosurgeon at Mass General Hospital perform brain surgery, and you mentioned in the book that the brain pulsates in rhythm with the human heart. We only have about 20 seconds left. If you could just tell us why that is.
It was pretty amazing. I guess it's just, you know, all the blood flow that's going through the brain. I mean, I actually watched brain surgery again last week for another story I'm doing, and I was struck by how many veins there were on it, you know, how many dark veins. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us, Adam Peori and The Bodybuilders. Thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Okay, we'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves eclectic American cuisine. Open nightly at 5:30 p.m., reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Want to thank the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design. It's time now for NPR News.